They had uncovered barely 15 miles the first day, had made camp beneath an overhang of rock. Huddling in his cloak, and resisting the urge to ignore Brother Artin's stern warning against lighting a fire. Sleep, when it came, was fitful, and troubled by dreams he could barely recall on waking, to the dull glimmer of dawn. The blood song was more muted now, but still clear, still leading him on to the fallen city, where he knew that Norta would be waiting. Norta. The anger returned, fierce and implacable. How could he do this? How could he? It had been building ever since Dentos related the tale, ever since the sickening realization that he would have to hunt down and kill his brother. He found himself unable to muster much regret over Battle Lord Alhestian's severed hand. It was hard to pity a man intent on venting his grief on helpless captives. But Norta, he'll fight, he knew with a dread certainty. He'll fight, and I'll kill him. He ate a breakfast of dried beef and set off through a light morning drizzle, leading Spit on foot as the ground was too rocky for riding. He had gone only a few miles when the Lonak attacked. The boy leapt from the rocks above in an impressive display of acrobatics, turning over in midair and landing nimbly on his feet in front of Valin, war club in one hand and a long curved knife in the other. He was bare-chested and lean as a greyhound. Valin guessed his age at somewhere between 14 and 16. His head was shaven, with an ornate tattoo above his left ear. His smooth, angular face tensed in anticipation of combat as he voiced a harsh challenge in a tongue Valin had never heard. "I'm sorry," Valin said. "I don't know your language." The Lonak boy evidently took this as either an insult or an acceptance of his challenge, since he attacked without further delay, leaping in the air, war club above his head, his knife hand drawn back for a slash. It was a practiced move, performed with elegant precision. Valin sidestepped the club as it came down, caught the knife hand in mid-slash, and knocked the boy unconscious with an open-handed blow to the temple. His hand went to his sword as he looked around for further enemies, eyes scanning the rocks above. "Where there's one, there's more," Brother Artin had warned him. "There are always more." There was nothing, no sound or scent on the wind, nothing to disturb the faint patter of rain on rock. Spit clearly sensed nothing either, as he began to nibble at the unconscious boy's leather-clad feet. Valin pulled him away, earning a near-miss kick from a forehoof, and crouched to check on the boy. His breathing was regular and there was no blood coming from his ears or nose. Valin positioned him so he wouldn't choke on his tongue, and tugged Spit onwards. After another hour, the gullies gave way to what Brother Artin had called the Anvil of Stone. It was the strangest and most unfamiliar landscape he had seen, a broad expanse of mostly bare rock, pocked by small pools of rainwater, and rocky tors rising from the undulating surface like great deformed mushrooms. He could only marvel at whatever design of nature had produced such a scene. The Cumbrailians claimed their god had made the earth and all it held in a blinking of his eye. But seeing the weather-fashioned channels in the tors rising above, he knew this place had taken many centuries to reach such a state of profound strangeness. He remounted Spit and headed north at a walk, covering another 10 miles before nightfall. He camped in the shelter of the largest tor he could find, his cloak once again tight around him as he sought sleep. His eyelids were drooping when the Lonak boy attacked again. The boy raged in his unfathomable language as Valin tied the rope around his chest, his hands already bound behind his back. A livid bruise marred his temple, and another was forming beneath his nose, where Valin's foreknuckles had found the nerve cluster which sent him senseless. "Nisha ulnis nisarantim!" the boy screamed at Valin, his bruised face rigid with hate. "Herin! Garnin!" "Oh, shut up," Valin said tiredly, pushing a rag into the boy's mouth. He left him writhing in his bonds and led Spit onwards, careful of his footing in the dark, although the half-moon was bright enough for him to make his way without misstep. He kept going until the boy's muffled cries were no longer audible, and found shelter next to a large boulder, lying down to let sleep claim him. The next day brought his first glimpse of sunlight, intermittent rays breaking through the clouds to play across the frozen rock of the anvil, drawing huge shadows from the tors, their weathered surfaces seeming to shimmer. Beautiful, he thought, wishing he had come here on a different mission. His heavy heart seemed to forbid enjoyment of simple things. The anvil stretched on for another 5 miles, eventually giving way to a series of low hills dotted with the stunted pine, which seemed to proliferate in the north. Spit spurred into an unbidden gallop as soon as his hooves touched the grass, snorting his relief at leaving the unyielding rock of the anvil. Balin gave him his head and let him run. Spit was ever a mean-spirited animal, and it was a novelty to feel the joy in him as he raced up and down the hills, churning sod in their wake. By nightfall they were in sight of the broad plateau where the fallen city waited. Balin found a campsite atop the last of the hills, affording a good view of the approaches, and cover from a cluster of pine near the summit. He tethered Spit to a low-hanging branch, and gathered wood, arranging it within a circle of rocks, adding pine shavings for kindling. He struck his flint and blew softly on the flames until the fire built. Sitting cross-legged, his sword still on his back and his bow within reach, an arrow already notched, he waited. He had become aware of being followed in the early evening, so there seemed little point in observing Artin's stricture against lighting a fire. Night came on quickly, the clouded sky making the darkness deep and impenetrable beyond the firelight. It was another hour before the soft scrape of hooves on sod told of a visitor. The man who walked into the camp stood at least 6.5 feet tall, with broad shoulders and thickly muscled arms, his chest confined within a bearskin vest that reached to his waist, where a war club and a steel-bladed hatchet hung on his belt. He wore deerskin trews and leather boots. Like the boy who had attacked Valen earlier, his head was shaven and tattooed, an intricate maze-like design that circled his head from temple to temple. More tattoos covered his arms, strange whorls and barb-like shapes, stretching from shoulder to wrist. His face was lean and angular, making it difficult to judge his age, but his eyes, dark and hostile beneath a heavy frown, spoke of many years, and if Valen was any judge, many battles. He was leading a sturdy pony that bore something slung across its back, something writhing and moaning in tight-bound rope. The Lonak pulled the hatchet and war club from his belt in a quick and skillful movement Valen almost didn't catch. He watched the man whirl the weapons expertly for a second or two, feeling the rush of displaced air and resisting the impulse to reach for his sword. The man's eyes never left his, studying, calculating. After a moment he grunted in apparent satisfaction, and laid both weapons on the ground near the fire. Taking a step backwards, hands raised, his expression no less hostile. Valen unbuckled his sword from his back, and placed it before him, also raising his hands. The Lonak grunted again, and went to the pony, pulling the bound boy from its back, and dumping him unceremoniously next to the fire. "This is yours," he told Valen, his words thickly accented but clearly spoken. Valen glanced at the boy, his mouth securely gagged with the leather strap, eyes dim with exhaustion. "I don't want it," he told the Lonak. The big man regarded him in silence for a moment, then moved to the opposite side of the fire, spreading his hands to the warmth. "Among my people, when a man comes to your fire in peace, it is custom to offer him meat and something to slake his thirst." Valen reached for his saddlebags and extracted some dried beef and a waterskin, tossing them to the Lonak across the fire. He took a small knife from his boot and cut a strip from the beef, chewing and swallowing quickly. Drinking from the waterskin, however, made him grimace and spit on the ground. "Where is the wine you Meriemhur love so much?" he demanded. "I rarely drink wine." Valen glanced again at the boy. "Aren't you going to let him eat, too?" "Whether he eats is your choice. He belongs to you." "Because I defeated him?" "If you defeat a man and you don't deign to kill him, he's yours." "And if I don't take him?" "He will lie here until he starves, or the beasts come to claim him. I could just cut his bonds, set him free." The Lonak barked a harsh laugh. "There is no freedom for him. He's varnish, defeated, destroyed. Worth no more than dog shit to my people." The man's gaze was fixed on the boy now, a fierce, implacable glower. "A fitting punishment for one who disobeys her word." who allows his misplaced pride to blind him to his obeisance. Cut his bonds and he will wander here, weaponless, friendless, while people will shun him, and he will find no shelter. His gaze swung back to Valin, the tension of his jaw and the set of his lips, telling of something more than anger, something too keenly felt to be hidden. Concern. He fears for the boy.
If he's mine, Valin said, then I may do with him as I wish.
The Lonak's eyes flicked back to the boy for an instant. He nodded.
Then I give him to you.
A gift of thanks for allowing me to cross your lands. The Lonak's face remained impassive, but Valin could read the relief in his eyes.
You Merimher are soft, he sneered. Weak and craven.
Only your numbers give you strength, and that'll not last forever.
One day we will sweep you back to the sea, and the waves will turn red with your blood.
He rose and went to the boy, using the boot knife to sever his bonds.
I'll take your worthless gift, since it's all you have to offer.
You're welcome. Free of the ropes, the boy was listless, sagging as the Lonak dragged him to his feet, whimpering as the big man slapped him awake with a chorus of curses in his own language. Once roused, the boy's gaze swung to Valin, the same hatred and bloodlust coloring his features again. He bridled, tensing himself for another attack. The big Lonak struck him, a hard, backhanded cuff across the face, drawing blood from his lip, then pushed him roughly to the waiting pony, hoisting him onto its back and pointing sternly back down the hill. The boy favored Valin with a last glare of naked animosity before spurring away into the darkness. The Lonak returned to the fire and reached for the dried beef once more, his face somber as he ate.
A good father suffers much for his son, Valin observed.
The Lonak's eyes flashed at him, the hostility shining once again.
Do not think there is a debt between us. Do not think you have bought passage through our lands with my son's life. You live because she wishes it.
She?
The Lonak shook his head in disgust. You have fought us for centuries, and you know so little of us. She is our guide and our protection. She is our wisdom and our soul. She rules us and serves us.
Valin recalled his dream meeting with Nyrsa Sil'nin in the Martish. What had she said about the Lonak?
I should have known the High Priestess would find a way.
High Priestess?
She leads you?
High Priestess. The Lonak spoke the words as if tasting unfamiliar fare.
As good a name as any.
Your bastard tongue does not fit easily with our ways.
You speak my bastard tongue very well. Where did you learn it?
The Lonak shrugged.
When we raid, we take captives, although they have little uses. The men are too weak to work the seams for more than a season without perishing, and the women bear sickly children. But once we took a man in a grey robe, called himself Brother Kellin.
He could heal and he could learn.
Came to speak our tongue like his own in time, so I made him teach me his.
Where is he now?
Sickened last winter. He was old. We left him out in the snow.
Valin was starting to understand why the Lonak were so widely despised.
So your High Priestess told you to let me pass?
Word came from the mountain. One of the Merimher would come along into our lands. Their greatest warrior seeking the blood of his brother. No harm will come to him.
The blood of his brother. The High Priestess sees much, it seems.
Why?
She does not explain. Words from the mountain are not to be questioned.
And yet your son tried to kill me.
Boys seek renown in forbidden deeds.
He had visions of defeating you and winning glory.
The keenest sword of the Merimher taken by his knife.
How could I have angered the gods so that they visit me with a fool for a son?
He hawked and spat into the fire, glancing up at Valin.
Why did you spare him?
There was no need to kill him.
Killing without need is against the faith.
Brother Kellin spoke often of your faith.
Endless lies.
How can a man have a creed but no god to punish him if he breaks it?
A god is a lie, and a man cannot be punished by a lie.
The Lonak chewed some more beef and shook his head. He seemed almost sorrowful.
I have heard the voice of the fire god, Nishak,
deep in the dark places under the smoking mountain. There was no lie in it. Fire god. Obviously the man had confused an echoing cavern for the voice of one of his gods.
What did he tell you?
Many things. None of the for your ears, Merimher. He tossed the beef and waterskin back to Valen. It's ill luck for a man to seek the death of his brother. Why do you do it?
Valen was tempted to ignore the question and sit in silence until the Lonak left. There seemed little left to talk about, and he certainly didn't cherish the man's company, but something made him voice the feelings that pained him so much. Easier to unburden yourself to a stranger.
He's not my brother in blood, but in faith. We are of the same order, and he has committed a great offense.
And so you will kill him?
I will have to. You will not let me take him back to face judgment.
Did the High Priestess tell you to let him pass also?
The Lonak nodded.
The Yellow Hair rode through 7 days ago, making for the Mars near Ulin Sol. You intend to follow him there?
I have to.
Then you'll most likely find a yellow-haired corpse waiting for you. There's only death in those ruins.
I've heard.
Do you know what it is that deals death in the Fallen City?
The Lonak's face twitched in annoyance. Fear was clearly a touchy subject.
Our people do not go there. Haven't for more than 5 winters. Even before then we didn't like the place.
There is a weight to the air that bears down on a man's soul.
Then the bodies started appearing. Seasoned hunters and warriors torn and rent by something unseen, their faces frozen in fear. A shameful end to be taken by a beast, even a beast of magic. He glanced up at Valen.
You go there, you'll soon be as dead as your brother.
My brother isn't dead.
He knew it, felt it in the constant note of the blood song.
Norta was still alive, waiting.
Abruptly, the Lonak reached for his weapons and rose to his feet, fixing Valen with a hostile glare.
We've talked long enough, Merimher.
I'll soil myself no longer with your company.
Valen Alsorna, Valen said.
The Lonak squinted at him suspiciously.
What?
My name.
Do you have one?
The Lonak regarded him in silence for a long time, the hostility fading from his gaze.
Eventually he shook his head. That is not your name.
Then he was gone, into the blackness beyond the fire without a sound. The tower must have stood over 200 feet high, and Valen could only imagine how impressive it had once looked. An arrow of red marble and grey granite pointing straight to the heavens. Now it was a broken and cracked road of weed-dotted rock, leading him to the heart of the fallen city. Looking closer, he noticed that the rubble was adorned with fine relief carvings, showing a myriad collection of beasts and frolicking naked humans. The stone friezes that decorated the older buildings of the capital were all martial in character, warriors fighting forgotten battles with archaic weaponry. But there were no battles here. The carvings seemed joyous, often carnal, but never violent. The morning sun had dawned behind a thick layer of cloud, bringing flurries of snow driven by a stiff wind he knew would only gain in strength as the day wore on. He closed his cloak against the chill, and urged spit onwards. Although he was less fractious than usual, there was a tension in the animal Valen hadn't sensed before. His eyes were wide, and he nickered nervously at the slightest sound. It was the city, he knew. The Lonak and Brother Artin hadn't exaggerated the oppression in the air. It thickened as he drew closer to the jagged outline of the ruins ahead, a dull ache building at the base of his skull. The blood song was different too, less constant in its tone, more urgent in its warning. He began to guide spit towards a central archway, near to where the fallen tower appeared to have had its base. They had only gone a few paces when spit began to tremble, his eyes widening further, rearing and casting his head about in alarm.
Easy!
Valen tried to calm him with a soft stroke to the neck. But the horse was uncontrollable with fear, giving a shrill whinny and tipping Valen from his back with a sudden lurch, then thundering away before Valen could grab at the reins.
"Come back, you bloody nag!" he raged.
The only answer was the distant drum of hooves.
"Should have cut his throat years ago," Valen muttered.
"Don't move, brother." Norta stood beneath the part-collapsed archway. His blonde hair was longer, reaching nearly to his shoulders, and the beginnings of a youthful beard showed on his chin. Instead of his brother's garb, he wore a set of buckskin trews and a leather jerkin. Apart from the hunting knife in his belt, he was unarmed. Velin had expected defiance, plus a modicum of the usual scorn and mockery, so was surprised that Norta's expression was one of grave concern.
"Brother," he addressed Norta formally, "Aspect Arlin commands your immediate return."
Norta barely seemed to hear him, edging closer with his hands raised, and Velin noticed how his eyes kept flicking to the side, focusing on something to the rear.
Velin whirled, his sword coming free from the scabbard in a blur.
"Don't!" Norta's shout came too late, as something large and immensely strong slammed into Valen's side, the force of the charge jarring his sword from his grip and sending him into the air to land a good 10 feet away, his breath forced from his lungs by the impact. He scrabbled for the dagger in his boot, dragging air into his lungs and trying to ignore the sharp pain in his chest, which told of at least one broken rib. He pushed himself upright, shouting with pain, and promptly fell again as a wave of nausea blurred his vision and tipped the ground beneath his feet. More than just a broken rib. He struggled, waving his dagger wildly, trying to rise and finding Norta standing over him. Velin drew back, expecting an attack, reversing his hold on the dagger to parry a thrust. Norta had his back to him, standing with his hands raised above his head, waving frantically.
"No! No! Leave him!"
There was a sound, like a snarl mixed with a growl, but it was not a sound any dog would ever make. Velin had seen wildcats in the Erlish and the Martish, but the beast that confronted him now was so different in size and shape, he almost concluded it was from another species altogether. It stood over 4 feet tall at the shoulder, its lean, powerful frame covered in snow-white fur, shot through with dark black stripes. Massive paws scraped at the ground, with claws more than 2 inches long, and its eyes, bright green and shining out from the complex striped mask of its face, seemed to glow with malevolent intent. Meeting his gaze, it hissed, bearing fangs like ivory daggers.
"No!"
Norta yelled, placing himself between the cat and Valin.
"No!"
The cat snarled again, raising a paw to slash the air in annoyance, then shifted to the left, seeking to edge past Norta. Valin was amazed. Does it fear him? A hand clap sounded, loud and sharp in the chilled mountain air. Velin tore his gaze from the snarling cat and saw a young woman standing a short distance away, a slender young woman with auburn hair and a familiar and very pretty oval face.
"Scylla," he said, wincing as a fresh wave of pain swept through him, his vision swimming.
When it cleared, he found her standing over him, smiling warmly. The cat was at her side now, nuzzling her leg as she played a hand through its fur. Behind her, he could see other figures emerging from the ruins. Dozens of people, young and old, men and women.
"Brother,"
Norta was kneeling next to him, his face pale with concern.
"Are you hurt?"
"I..."
Meeting Norta's gaze and seeing the worry in his eyes, he felt a great swell of shame in his breast. "I came here to kill you, my friend. What kind of man am I?"
"I'm fine," he said, pushing himself upright and promptly passing out from the savage flare of agony in his chest.
Chapter 8 He was woken by voices, softly spoken but tense with conflict.
"A danger to us all,"
a man was whispering heatedly.
"No more than I," answered a familiar voice. "You're as much a fugitive as we are, brother. He is a member of an order that kills our kind. This man is under my protection. No harm will come to him. I'm not talking about harming him. There are other ways we can keep him sleeping."
"A bit late for that," Velin said, opening his eyes. He lay on a bed of furs in a large, bare room, the walls and ceiling richly decorated with faded paintings of animals and strange sea creatures he couldn't name. The floor was covered in an elaborate mosaic, showing a pear tree laden with fruit, surrounded by unfamiliar symbols and intricate swirling patterns. Norta stood near the door, accompanied by a slightly built man, with graying hair and wary eyes.
"Brother,"
Norta said with a smile,
"you are well?"
Velin felt at his side, expecting to find it tender to the touch, but there was no pain.
Pulling down the furs, he saw the livid bruise he expected was absent, his flesh smooth and unmarked.
It appears so. Thought that beast had broken a rib, at least.
She did more than that, the slightly built man said. Weaver had to spend half the night on you. Snowdance is not an easy animal to control, even for Sella.
Snowdance?
The cat, Norton explained. A war cat, left behind by the Ice Horde. It seems some of them made the mistake of wandering into Lonak lands after the Tower Lord sent them packing. Sella found her when she was a kitten. Apparently she's not yet fully grown.
Grown large and ferocious enough to keep us safe,
the other man said, giving Valen a cold look.
Until now.
This is Harlech, Norta said. He's scared of you. Most of them are.
Them?
The people who live here. And a very strange bunch they are, too. He went to a corner where Valen's clothes and weapons were neatly arranged and tossed him a shirt.
Get dressed, and I'll give you a tour of the fallen city.
Outside, the sun was bright and high, warming the air and banishing shadows from the ruins. They emerged from what appeared to have been an official building of some kind. Its size and the cluster of symbols carved into the lintel above the entrance marked it out as a place of importance.
Harlech thinks it was a library, Norta said.
He should know. Used to be a man of importance in the great library in Varenshold.
What became of all the books, however?
He shrugged.
Gone to dust ages past, most like, Valen said.
Looking around, he was struck by an impression of beauty despoiled. The elegance of the buildings, evident in every line and carving, had been displaced and disfigured by the city's fall. His eyes picked out marks in the stonework, and the broken statues. Not cracks of age, but scars hewn into the stone. Elsewhere he noted the way all the taller buildings had fallen in different directions, as if pulled down at random. There was a violence to the destruction that spoke of more than the deprivations of passing years and harshness of the elements.
This place was attacked, he murmured.
Torn down centuries ago.
Sella said the same thing.
Norta's face clouded a little.
She has dreams sometimes. Bad dreams about what happened here.
Valen turned to face him, searching his face for signs of wrongness. Norta was certainly different. The weariness that had dulled his eyes since their time in the Martish was gone, replaced by something Valen took a moment to recognize.
He's happy.
Brother, he said, I must know. Has she touched you?
Norta's expression was both amused and guarded.
My father once told me there are some things a true nobleman does not discuss.
Valen was momentarily undecided whether to be jealous or angry that Norta could throw off his vows so easily.
He surprised himself by finding he was neither.
I meant...
There was a rapid scrape of claws on stone, and Valen fought to contain his alarm as the war cat Snowdance bounded toward them, leaping a fallen column and nearly knocking Norta from his feet as she pressed her great head against him, purring loudly.
Hello, you vicious beast, Norta greeted her, tickling her behind the ears, for all the world as if he were petting a kitten.
Valen couldn't stop himself edging away. The obvious power of the animal made even Scratch look weak in comparison.
She won't hurt you, Norta assured him, scratching the cat's jaw as she angled her head.
Sella won't let her. Norta led him through the ruins to a cluster of buildings that seemed more intact than the others. There were people there, about 30 in all, of varying ages, with a few children running about. Most of the adults regarded Valen with a mixture of fear and suspicion. A few were openly hostile. Oddly, they showed no fear of Snowdance, a couple of children even running over to pet her.
Why didn't you take his sword?
A tall man with a black beard demanded of Norta. He was clutching a heavy quarterstaff, and a little girl was peering out from behind his legs, eyes wide with fear and curiosity.
It's not mine to take, Norta replied in a placid tone. And I'd advise you not to try, Ranil.
Valen was struck by the way the people avoided his gaze as they moved through the camp. A couple even covered their faces, although he knew none of them. There was also a murmur from the blood song, a tone he hadn't heard before. It felt almost like recognition. Norta paused next to a heavily built young man who, unlike the others, paid them no attention at all. He sat surrounded by piles of rushes, his hands moving deftly as he worked them together, interlacing the long stems with unconscious skill. A number of completed conical baskets lay nearby, each one seemingly identical.
"This is Weaver," Norta told Valen. "You have him to thank for your unbroken ribs."
"You're a healer, sir?" Valen asked the young man.
Weaver stared up at Valen with blank eyes and a vague smile on his broad face. After a moment he blinked, as if recognizing Valen for the first time.
"All broken up inside," he said in a rapid tumble of words Valen almost didn't catch. "Bones and veins and muscles and organs needed fixing, long time fixing."
"You fixed me?" Valen asked.
"Fixed,"
Weaver repeated. He blinked again and returned to his task, his fingers resuming their expert work without further pause. He didn't look up as Norta drew Valen away.
"He's slow of mind?" Valen asked.
"No one's quite sure.
He sits weaving his baskets all day, rarely speaks. The only time he's not weaving is when he's healing.
How can he have learned the healing arts?"
Norta paused and rolled up the shirt sleeve on his left arm. There was a thin scar running along the forearm, faded and barely noticeable. "When I cut my way out of the Battle Lord's tent, one of his hawks caught me with a lance. I stitched it best I could, but I'm no healer. By the time I made it into the mountains, the gangrene had set in. The flesh around the cut was black and stinking. When I found myself among these people, Weaver put down his rushes, came over and put his hands on my arm. It felt warm, almost like burning. When he took his hands away, the wound looked like this."
Valen looked back at Weaver, sitting surrounded by his rushes and baskets, and felt the bloodsong murmur again.
"The dark," he said, as he glanced around at the wary faces of the others. The meaning of the song's new tone became clear.
"They all have it."
Norta leaned close, speaking softly.
"So do you, brother. How else could you find me?"
He grinned at the shock on Valen's face.
"You hid it so well all these years.
None of us had any idea, but you couldn't hide it from her. She told me what you did for her, for which I thank you most humbly. After all, we'd never have met if you hadn't. Come on, she's waiting." They found Sela encamped in a large plaza in the center of the city, smoke rising from a campfire, above which a steaming pot of stew was suspended. She wasn't alone, Spitz snorting happily as she ran her hand over his flanks. His snorts turned to a familiar whinny of irritation as Valen approached, as if he resented the intrusion. Sela's embrace was warm and her smile wide, although he noted she wore gloves and avoided contact with his skin. Her hands moved with the clean fluency he remembered.
"You're taller," she said.
"And you?"
He nodded at Spit, now nuzzling a gorse bush with studied indifference to his master.
"He likes you. Usually he hates everyone on sight."
"Not hate," her hand said. "Anger. His memory is long for a horse. He remembers the plains where he grew up. Endless grass, boundless skies. Hungers to return." She paused to press a kiss to Norta's lips, as he pulled her close with easy familiarity, provoking a moment of unease. "So, she has touched him." Spit gave an abrupt whinny of alarm when Snowdance came bounding into view, and would have fled if Sela hadn't calmed him with a handstroke to his neck. She turned her gaze to the warcat, halting her in mid-stride. Valen felt a whisper of the bloodsong as Sela's gaze remained locked on the cat. After the briefest pause, Snowdance blinked, shaking her head in confusion, then bounded off in another direction, quickly disappearing into the ruins.
"Wants to play with your horse," Sela said.
"She'll stay away from him now." She moved to the campfire, lifting the stew pot from its tripod.
"Will you eat with us, brother?" Norta asked.
Valen realized he was fiercely hungry.
"Gladly."
The stew was goat meat, seasoned with thyme and sage, which apparently grew in abundance amidst the ruins. Valen wolfed down a bowl with his customary lack of manners, noting Norta's wince of apology in Sela's direction. She just smiled and shook her head.
"How's Dentos?" Norta asked.
"Bruised? You nearly broke his cheekbone."
"He damn near broke mine. The hawks didn't get him then. He made it safely back to the High Keep."
"I'm glad.
He and the others, were they angry?"
"No.
They were worried. I was angry."
Norta's smile was tight, almost wary.
"Did you come here to kill me, brother?"
Velin met his gaze squarely. I knew you wouldn't let me take you back.
You were right. And now?
Velin pointed to the medallion chain around Norta's neck and gestured for him to hand it over.
Norta hesitated briefly, then took out the small metal icon of the blind warrior, hooking the chain over his head and tossing it into Velin's palm.
Now there's no need, Velin said, putting the chain around his own neck. Since you unwisely fled into Lonak territory, weakened by your wound, having fought off several Lonak attacks, you sadly fell victim to an unnamed but famously savage beast known to dwell near the fallen city. He touched a hand to the medallion. I could scarcely recognize your remains but for this.
Would they believe you? Sela asked.
Velin shrugged. They believed what I told them about you. Besides, it's the king's belief that matters, and I suspect he will choose to take my word without further investigation.
So you do have the king's ear, Norta mused.
We always suspected. Did the battle lord live?
So it seems. The realm guard have returned to Azrael, and Lord Muster is now installed as fief lord in the Cumbrelian capital.
And the Cumbrelian prisoners?
Velin hesitated.
He had heard the story from Brother Artin, and wasn't sure how Norta would react to the news, but decided he deserved to hear the truth.
The Battle Lord is popular with the Hawks, as you know. After what you did to him, they rioted. The prisoners were slaughtered to a man.
Norta's face sagged with sorrow.
All for nothing, then.
Sela reached over to clasp his hand briefly.
Not for nothing, her hands told him. You found me.
Norta forced a smile and got to his feet.
I should hunt.
He planted a kiss on her cheek and shouldered his bow and quiver.
We're running short of meat, and I suspect you both have much to discuss.
Velin watched him walk off towards the northern edge of the city. After a moment, Snowdance emerged to pad alongside him.
I know what you're thinking, Sela said when he turned back.
You touched him, Velin replied.
Not how you think, her hands insisted. You have something of mine.
Velin nodded, fishing inside his collar for the silk scarf she had given him. He untied it from his neck and handed it to her, feeling oddly reluctant. It had been his talisman for so long its absence felt strange, unnerving.
Sela smiled sadly as she laid the scarf out on her knees, her fingers tracing over the delicate gold thread pattern.
Mother wore this all her life, she signed. When she passed, it came to me. Its message is precious to those who believe as we do.
See?
She pointed at the sigil woven into the silk, a crescent encircled by a ring of stars. The moon, the sign of calm reflection, from where reason and balance are derived.
Here.
She pointed to a golden circle ringed with flame. The sun, source of passion, love, anger. Her finger traced to the tree in the center of the scarf. We exist here, between the two. Grown from the earth, warmed by the sun, cooled by the moonlit night. Your brother's heart had been pulled too far into the realm of the sun, fired with anger and regret. Now he is cooled, and he looks to the moon for guidance.
By his choice or by your touch?
Her smile became shy.
I feared him when Snowdance called to me with news of his coming. We found him fallen from his horse, raving with fever from his wound. The others wanted to kill him, but I wouldn't let them. I knew what he was. A man with his skills may have been useful to us. And so I touched him.
She paused, looking down at her gloved hands.
Nothing happened.
For the first time, no rush of power, no sense of control. A slow flush crept up her cheeks.
I can touch him.
Something for which I am sure he's very grateful, Velin thought, fighting a pang of envy.
He does not do your bidding.
He is not...
He fumbled for the right words.
Enslaved?
Mother told me it would be this way. One day I would meet someone who would be immune to my touch, and we would be bound together.
It is always this way for those with our gift. Your brother is as free as he ever was.
Her smile faded, sympathy coloring her eyes.
More free than you, I think. Valin looked away.
He told me what Weaver did for him, he said, desiring a change of subject.
All the people here are touched by the dark, are they not?
Her hands twitched in annoyance, and a frown creased her brow.
The dark is a word for the ignorant. The people here are gifted. Different powers, different abilities, but gifted. Like you.
He nodded.
That's what you saw in me all those years ago. You knew it before I did.
Your gift is rare and precious. My mother called it the Hunter's Call. In the days of the Four Fiefs, it was known as the Battle Sight.
The Sjorda.
Bloodsong, he said.
She nodded.
It's grown since our last meeting. I can feel it.
You have honed it, learned its music well. But there is still so much to learn.
You can teach me?
He was surprised at the hope evident in his voice.
She shook her head.
No, but there are others, older and wiser, with the same gift. They can guide you.
How do I find them?
Your song links you to them.
It will find them.
All you must do is follow.
Remember, it is a rare gift you hold. It may be years before you find one who can guide you.
Valin hesitated before asking his next question. He had kept the secret so long, it was a habit he found hard to break.
There is something I need to know. How can it be that I have faced two men, now dead, who both spoke with the same voice?
Her face was suddenly guarded, and it was a moment before her hand spoke again.
They wished you ill, these men?
He thought of the assassin in the House of the Fourth Order, and the murderous desperation of Henter's muster.
Yes, they wished me ill.
Sela's hands now moved with a strange hesitancy he hadn't seen before.
There are stories among the gifted.
Old stories, myths.
Of gifted who could return.
He frowned.
Return from where?
From the place where all journeys end.
From the beyond.
From death.
They take the bodies of the living, wear them like a cloak. Whether such a thing can truly be done, I don't know.
Your words are troubling.
Once there were seven. You know what this means?
There were once seven orders of your faith.
An old story.
A true story?
She shrugged.
Your faith is not mine. I know little of its history.
He glanced back at the camp and its fearful inhabitants.
These people all follow your beliefs?
She gave a small laugh and shook her head.
Only I follow the path of the sun and the moon here.
Amongst us are questers, ascendants, followers of the Cumberland God, and even some adherents of your faith.
Belief does not bind us. Our gifts do that.
Elin guided all these people here.
Some.
There were only Harlech and a few others when he first brought me here.
Others came later, fleeing the fears and hatreds our kind attracts, called by their gifts.
This place.
She gestured at the surrounding ruins.
Once there was great power here.
The gifted were protected in the city, vaunted even.
The echo of that time is still strong enough to call us.
You can feel it, can't you?
He nodded. The atmosphere seemed less oppressive now he knew its meaning.
Lorta said you have bad dreams of this city.
Of what happened here.
Not all bad.
Sometimes I see how it was before the fall. There were many wonders here. A city of artists, poets, singers, sculptors. They had mastered so much, learned so much. They felt themselves invulnerable, thinking the gifted among them all the protection they needed. They had lived in peace for generations and had no warriors, so when the storm came they were naked before it.
Storm?
Many centuries ago, before our kind came to these shores, before even the Lonak and the Sjorda, there were many cities like this. This land was rich in people and beauty. Then the storm came and tore it all down. A storm of steel and twisted power. They swept aside the gifted, who fought them, and vented all their hate on this city. The city they hated most of all.
She paused, a shudder making her pull her shawl around her shoulders.
Rape and massacre. The burning of children. Men ate the flesh of other men. Every horror imaginable was visited here. Who were they? The men who did this. She shook her head vaguely. The dreams tell me nothing of who they were, or from where they came. I think it's because the people who lived here didn't know either. The dreams are the echo of their lives. They only show me what they knew. She closed her eyes for a moment, clearing her head of the memory, then deftly folded the scarf on her knees and held it out to him. I can't, he said. It was your mother's. Her gloved hands took his and pressed the scarf into them. A gift. I have much to thank you for, and only this to show it. In the evening, they shared a brace of rabbits Norta had brought back from this hunt, regaling Sela with the more humorous tales of their days in the Order. Strangely, these stories felt dated, as if they were two old men spinning yarns of long ago. It occurred to him that for Norta, the Order was now part of his past. He had progressed. Valen and his brothers were no longer his family. He had Sela now. Sela and the other gifted, huddling in their ruin. You know, it's not safe to stay here, he told Sela. The Lonak will not tolerate your war cat forever. And sooner or later, Aspect Tendris is bound to send a stronger expedition to solve the mystery of this place. She nodded, hands moving in the firelight. We will have to leave soon. There are other refuges we can seek. Come with us, Norta suggested. You do have more right to join this odd company than I, after all. Valen shook his head. I belong with the Order, brother. You know that. I know there's nothing but war and killing in your future if you stay with them. And what do you think they'll do when they find out your secret? Valen shrugged to mask his discomfort. Norta was right, of course, but his conviction was unshaken. Despite the burden of many secrets and the blood he had spilt, despite his ache for Sherin and the sister he would never know, he knew he belonged with the Order. He hesitated before saying what he knew he had to say next. The secret had been kept too long, and the guilt weighed heavily. Your mother and your sisters are in the Northern Reaches, he told Norta. The king found a place for them there after your father's execution. Norta's face was unreadable. How long have you known this? Since the test of the sword. I should have told you before. I'm sorry. I hear Tower Lord Almirna is tolerant of other faiths within his lands. You may find refuge there. Norta stared into the fire, his face tense. Sela put her arm around his shoulders and laid her head on his chest. His face softened as he stroked her hair. Yes, you should have told me, he said to Valen. But thank you for telling me now. Some children came running out of the darkness, laughing and clustering around Norta. Story! They chanted, story, story! Norta tried to placate them, saying he was too tired, but they pestered him even more until he relented. What kind of story? Battles, a little boy cried as they sat round the fire. No battles, insisted a little girl Valen recognized as the fearful, wide-eyed child from the camp. Battles are boring, scary story. She climbed into Sela's lap and settled into her arms. The other children took up the cry, and Norta waved them to silence, his face taking on a mock-serious countenance. Scary story it is. But, he held up a finger, this is not a story for the faint of heart or the weak of bladder. This is the most terrible and frightful of tales, and when I am done, you may curse my name for ever having voiced it. His voice dropped to a whisper, and the children leaned closer to catch his words. This is the tale of the witch's bastard. It was an old tale Valen knew well. A dark, afflicted witch from a Renfalen village snared the local blacksmith into lying with her, and of their union a vile creature in the shape of a human boy was born, destined to bring about the ruin of the village and the death of his father. He thought it an odd choice of story for these children, given as it was often used to warn of the dangers of dabbling in the dark. But they listened avidly, eyes wide as Norta set the scene. In the darkest part of the darkest woods in old Renfale, before the time of the realm there stood a village. And in this village there dwelt a witch, comely to the eye
but with a heart blacker than the blackest night.
Velin rose quietly and made his way through the darkened ruins to the main camp, where suspicious eyes stared at him from makeshift shelters. There were a few guarded nods of greeting, but none of the gifted spoke to him. They must know I'm one of them, he thought. But still they fear me. He continued on to the building where he had awoken that morning, the place Norta called a library. There was a faint glow of firelight in the doorway, and he lingered outside a moment to ensure there were no voices. He wanted a private conversation with Harlech, the one-time librarian. He found the man reading by his fire, the smoke escaping through a hole in the ceiling. Looking closer at the fire, Velin noted it had an unusual fuel. Instead of wood, the flames licked at curled, blackened pages and blistered leather bindings. His suspicions were confirmed when Harlech turned the last page of his book, closed it, and tossed it into the flames. "I was once told to burn a book is a heinous crime," Velin observed, recalling one of his mother's many lectures on the importance of learning. Harlech jerked to his feet in fright, taking a few wary backward steps.
"What do you want?"
he demanded, the quaver in his voice draining any threat from the words.
"To talk."
Velin entered and crouched next to the fire, warming his hands and watching the books burn. Harlech said nothing, crossing his arms and refusing to meet his gaze.
"You are gifted," Velin continued. "You must be, or you wouldn't be here."
Harlech's eyes flashed at him.
"Don't you mean afflicted, brother? You have no need to fear me. I have questions. Questions a man of learning might be able to answer. Especially a man with a gift."
"And if I can't answer?"
Velin shrugged. "I shall seek answers elsewhere."
He nodded at the fire.
"For a librarian, you seem to have little respect for books."
Harlech bridled, anger overcoming his fear.
"I have given my life to the service of knowledge. I will not justify myself to one who does little but litter the realm with corpses."
Velin inclined his head.
"As you wish, sir. But I should still like to ask you my questions. You may answer or no, the choice is your own."
Harlech pondered in silence for a moment, then moved back to the fur-covered stool beside the fire, resuming his seat and cautiously meeting Velin's eye.
"Ask, then. Is the Seventh Order of the Faith truly extinct?"
The man's gaze dropped immediately, fear once more clouding his face. He didn't speak for a long time, and when he did, his words were a whisper.
"Have you come here to kill me? I am not here for you. You know that. But you are in search of the Seventh Order."
"My search is in service to the faith and the realm," he frowned, realizing the import of what Harlech had said.
"You are of the Seventh Order?"
Harlech seemed shocked.
"You mean to say you do not know? Why else would you be here?"
Velin was undecided whether to laugh or cuff the man in frustration.
"I came in search of my fugitive brother,"
he told Harlech patiently.
"Not knowing what I would find. I know a little of the Seventh Order and wish to know more. That is all."
Harlech's face became rigid, as if he feared any display of emotion could betray him.
"Would you reveal the secrets of your order, brother?"
"Of course not."
"Then do not expect me to divulge the secrets of mine. You can torture me, I know, but I'll tell you nothing."
Velin saw how the man's hands trembled in his lap, and couldn't help admiring his courage. He had thought the Seventh Order, if it still existed, a malign group of dark, afflicted conspirators. But this frightened man, and his simple courage, spoke of something different.
"Did the Seventh Order orchestrate the killing of Aspect Sentis and Morvin?"
he demanded more harshly than intended.
"Did they try to assassinate me during the test of the run? Did they deceive Hentis Muster into murdering his father?"
Harlech flinched, gasping out a noise that was half a sob and half a laugh.
"The Seventh Order guards the mysteries," he said, the words sounding like a quotation. "It practices its arts in service of the faith. It has always been thus. There was a war, centuries ago, between the orders, a war begun by the Seventh Order."
Harlech shook his head.
"The Seventh went to war with itself.
It was sundered from within. The other orders were drawn into the conflict. The war was long and terrible. Thousands died. When it was over, those of the Seventh who remained were feared beyond reason by the people and the nobility. Conclave decided the Seventh would disappear from the fiefs and be seen no more by the people. Its house was destroyed, its books burned, its brothers and sisters scattered and hidden. But the faith requires there to be a Seventh Order, visible or no. You mean the Seventh Order was never truly destroyed? It works in secret. I've told you too much. Ask me no more. Do the Aspects know? Harlech shut his eyes tight and said nothing. Suddenly furious, Velen grabbed the man, lifting him clear of the stool, forcing him against the wall. Do the Aspects know? Harlech shrank from him, quailing in his grasp, words bubbling from his lips amidst panic spittle. Of course they know. They know everything. Memories came in a flood as Harlech's words struck home. The shift in Master Solace's eyes when he first said, once there were seven. Aspect Alera's instant of fear at the same words, the way Solace had exchanged glances with her after they told the tale of One-Eye's dark abilities, and the knowledge behind Aspect Arlin's eyes. Am I a fool, he wondered, for not seeing this? The Aspects have been lying to the faithful for centuries. He released Harlech and went back to the fire. The books were little more than ash now, the leather bindings curled and charred black amidst the embers. The other gifted. They don't know, do they? He asked, glancing back at Harlech. They don't know what you are. Harlech shook his head. You have a mission here? I cannot tell you anything further, brother. Harlech's voice was strained but determined. Please do not ask me. As you wish, brother. He went to the doorway, gazing out at the moonlit ruins. I would be grateful if you would omit mention of Brother Norta's survival in any report you make to your Aspect. Harlech shrugged. Brother Norta is not my concern. Thank you. He wandered the ruins for hours, memories playing through his mind in a torrent. They knew. All this time, they knew. He couldn't decide if his confusion was born of betrayal or something deeper. The Aspects embody the virtues of the faith. They are the faith. If they have lied... I really wish you'd come with us. He looked up, finding Norta perched atop a massive piece of fallen statuary. It took Velen a moment to recognize it as the marble head of a bearded man. His carved expression, one of deep contemplation. Surely one of the city's luminaries commemorated in stone. Was he a philosopher or a king? A god, perhaps. Velen leaned against the statue's forehead, running a hand over the deep lines in his brows. Whoever or whatever he had been was forgotten now. No more than a great stone head, waiting for the ages to turn him to dust in a city where no one was left to remember his name. I can't, he told Norta eventually. You don't sound so certain now. Perhaps I'm not. Even so, there's much I need to know. I'll only find answers in the Order. Answers to what? There's something growing. A threat, a danger. Something that threatens us all. I've felt it for a long time. Although it's only now I realize it. Velen left it unsaid. Norta had a new path now. A new family. Sharing would only burden him. We're all looking for answers, brother, he said. Though you appear to have found yours. That I have. Norta leapt down from the statue and held out his sword. You should take this as well as the talisman. It'll add to your proof. You may need it. The road to the northern reaches will be long and hazardous. These people will need your protection. There are other forms of protection. I've spilled enough blood with this. I intend to live the rest of my days without taking another life. Velen took the sword. When will you leave? There's no point waiting for winter. Convincing the others may be difficult, though. Some of them have been here for years. He paused, his expression oddly sheepish. I didn't kill the bear. What? During the test of the wild, I didn't kill it. The shelter I built collapsed in the wind. I was desperate, freezing, wandering in the snow. I found a cave,
and thought the departed had guided me to shelter. Unfortunately, the bear who lived there didn't appreciate visitors. It chased me for miles, all the way to the edge of a cliff. I managed to grab onto a branch. The bear wasn't so lucky. Kept me fed for a while, though. Velin laughed. The sound was strange amidst the ruins, out of place.
You bloody liar!
Norta grinned. Next to the bow, it was my major talent. His smile faded. I'll miss you, and the others. Can't say I'm sorry about the battle, Lord, though. They walked back to the camp, fed the waning fire, and talked of the Order and the Brothers for hours. When Norta finally went to the shelter he shared with Sela, Velin settled down in his cloak, knowing that in the morning he would wake early and leave without a farewell. The reason came to him before he tumbled into sleep. I want to stay. Part 4. In addition to his many lies regarding the supposed perfidy of Alperian interlopers, King Janus had need of a legal device to supplement his premise for war. Accordingly, extensive digging into the royal archive unearthed an obscure treaty dating back some 400 years. What was in fact a lapsed and fairly standard trade agreement on tariffs between the Lord of Azrael and the then-independent states of Untesh and Marbellis, enabled the King's Lord of Justice to seize on a minor clause formalizing arrangements to cooperate in suppressing Maldinian pirates. Through a mixture of inventive translation from the original Alperian text and basic sophistry, this clause was twisted into an invitation to assume sovereignty. Thus was the lie fabricated that the invasion was simply a seizure of property that already belonged to the king. The invasion fleet arrived off the Alperian coast on the 96th day of Emperor Alaren's reign, all praises, wisdom and benevolence. Although the recent deterioration in relations between our empire, may it live forever, and the unified realm, had caused some imperial advisers to warn of a possible invasion, the comparative smallness of King Janus's fleet led many to discount their fears. The imperial mathematician Rerian Alturs calculated that to deposit the realm guard on our coast would require a fleet of at least 1,500 ships, and the realm possessed barely 500, of which only half were warships. Sadly, no word had reached our ears of the treacherous actions of the Maldinian pirate nation. May the ocean rise to swallow their islands, in agreeing to ferry the realm forces across the Irinian Sea. Sources disagree on the price paid by Janus for this service, opinion ranging from no less than 3 million gold pieces to the offer of his daughter in marriage to a Maldinian of suitable rank. But the cost must have been high indeed for the pirates to set aside their hatred of the Northmen, born of the destruction of their city 20 years earlier. It was the greatest misfortune that the Hope was at that very moment engaged in a ceremonial visit to the temple of the goddess Muisil in Untesh, accompanied by 100 men of the Imperial Horse Guard. He was therefore only 10 miles from the landing site when a terrified fisherman arrived with news of a Maldinian raiding party of previously unseen size. The Hope immediately mobilized the local garrison, some 3,000 horse and 5,000 spears, setting out in the dead of night to confront the invaders and sweep them back into the sea. It took several hours to assemble the force and march to the coast. If his force had moved only fractionally quicker, the Hope would have had a chance to deal a serious, possibly fatal blow to the forces still assembling on the beach. However, the 1st Realm Guard Regiment to land had already formed ranks to defend the narrow track through the dunes leading to the beach. At their head was the most fanatical and ferocious warrior priest of the Unified Realm's heretic faith, Valin Ilsorna. Curse his name for all the ages. Vernias, Alish Somerin, The Great War of Salvation, Volume 1, Unrevised Text, Alperian Imperial Archives. Vernia's account. It must have pained you, I said, finding your brother's body, seeing him so mutilated. The Northman got to his feet, rubbing at the stiffness in his legs and groaning as he stretched his back. Not the most pleasant sight, he agreed. I gave what was left to the fire, took his sword and his medallion back to the Order. The King and Aspect Arlin accepted my word without question. The Battle Lord, understandably, was less trusting, naming me a traitor and a liar.
I think he would have challenged me too if the king hadn't ordered him to silence.
And the mysterious beast that killed Norta, I said. Did you ever discover what manner of creature it was?
They say wolves grow large in the north. In the eastern crags there are ferocious apes twice the size of a man, with faces like dogs.
He shrugged. There are many dangers in nature. He moved to the stairs leading to the deck and began to ascend.
I feel the need of some fresh air.
I followed him out into the night. The sky was cloudless and the moon bright, painting the ship's rigging a pale blue as it swayed in the stiff sea breeze. The only crewmen I could see were the helmsman and the dim shape of a boy perched high on the mainmast.
"Captain told you to stay in the hold," the helmsman growled.
"Then go and wake him," I suggested before joining Alsauna. He stood resting his forearms on the rail, staring out at the moonlit sea, his expression distant.
"The teeth of Mesis," he said,
pointing to a cluster of white specks in the distance, where waves were breaking on a series of jagged rocks.
"Mesis is the Meldinian god of the hunt, a great serpent who fought Margentis, the giant orca god, for a day and a night. So great was their struggle, they made the sea boil and forced the continents apart. When it was over and Mesis floated dead in the surf, his body rotted away, but his teeth were left to mark his passing. His spirit joined with the sea, and when the Meldinians rose to hunt the waves, it was to him they looked for guidance, for his teeth marked the way to their homeland. We're in Meldinian waters now, where I believe your ships never venture."
"Meldinians are pirate scum," I said simply, "and our ships would make a valuable prize."
"And yet the Lady Emerin's vessel was taken here."
I said nothing. I had unsettling questions of my own on this matter, but was reluctant to discuss them with him.
"I understand the ship and crew were allowed to sail on their way," he went on. "Only the lady was taken."
I coughed. "The pirates no doubt recognized her value for ransom."
"Except they asked for no ransom, only for me to come and fight their champion."
His mouth twitched, and I realized I was being baited.
I recalled Emerin's bitter audience with the Emperor after the Northman's trial, where she had begged for his sentence to be changed.
"A death demands a death," she had railed, her fine features contorted with rage.
"The gods demand it. The people demand it. My fatherless son demands it. And I demand it, sire, as widow to the murdered hope of this empire."
In the chill silence that followed her tirade, the Emperor sat silent and unmoving on his throne. The attending guards and courtiers shocked and stiff with trepidation, their eyes fixed firmly on the floor. When the Emperor finally spoke, his voice was toneless and devoid of anger, as he decreed the Lady Emerin had offended his person and was banished from court until further notice. As far as I knew, they hadn't exchanged a single word since.
"Suspect what you wish," I told Alsauna.
"But no, the Emperor does not scheme. He would never indulge in revenge. His every action is in service to the Empire."
He laughed. "Your emperor has sent me to the islands to die, my lord, so the Meldinians can have their revenge on my father, and the lady can witness the death of the man who killed her husband. I wonder if it was her idea or theirs." I couldn't fault his reasoning. He was, of course, expected to die. The Hope Killer's end would be the final act in the trauma of our war with his people, the epilogue to the epic of conflict. Whether this had been in the Emperor's mind when he agreed to the Meldinians' offer, I truly don't know. In any case, Alsauna seemed free of fear and resigned to his fate. I wondered if he actually expected to survive his duel with the shield, reputedly the finest swordsman ever to wield a blade. The Hope Killer's story had left me in little doubt as to his own deadly abilities, but they were sure to have been dulled by his years of captivity. Even if he did prevail,